I think we're still broadcasting over the net, so even though it seems like such a conceit to be using a microphone when there's about a dozen of us here. So I want to start just by posing the question, or a question as I see it, and get into the discussion of it. This question is, should we care whether the code that we run on is ours? And I've asked Eric Wiseman to help facilitate this. I don't know if he's still interested in doing so. Well, there's more than one baton.
I can walk around with you, but the
Well, just tell me, Eric, do you care, do you think we should care whether the code we run on is ours? Let's say we have ideas about ways to use software in a given class. Should we care whether it comes from Microsoft in a box, we pay some money, it's not that expensive, and we use it, or whether we grow our own and it's...
What kind of class?
Suppose it's something we would use in our lecture and discussion series, like the Terry's Intellectual Property and Cyberspace course.
I don't have as easy a time separating what people have referred to earlier today as content from the mechanism that delivers it or provides it or hosts it or enables it. And I think it's as important to understand and be able to, you know, tweak, change, read the mechanisms that are providing the ability to interact and learn as it is to interact and learn. And that's part of the discussion that's going on.
But is my life any different if I write an essay, say, coming out of today, I'm inspired to write something about the day? Does it really matter to me that I write it on Microsoft Word versus writing it on, you know, GNU Emacs?
And so you want to share?
The essay?
Yeah.
I can still share the essay at large, right? I could even save it as text format.
Well, sure, but then you take it out of Microsoft's proprietary format and put it in the format in which it can read openly.
Right, which Microsoft lets me do, since I can do the save as, and then the little paperclip comes up and says, are you absolutely sure you don't want to save this as a Microsoft Word? Yeah.
When you're done branding, you do have that opportunity, certainly.
Yeah. Ben?
I'll talk into the microphone. I guess for me, it comes down to making a distinction between my end and the means to the end. So if I come out of today with some bright idea, or at least something I think is a bright enough idea that maybe someone else cares, my goal is probably to write it up as quickly as I can before all of you don't care, or have heard it somewhere else, or have forgotten what we were talking about today, or just because I'm busy, I want to get it done with and go on to something else. And so for me, it's probably most important that I have the tool that does the job most easily, most quickly. All other things being equal, certainly, if there weren't this consideration of I'd like to use open code, I'd like to use code that I own, certainly I'd want the best tool. What I'd be crazy to say, you know, I'll take the tool that doesn't work so well, because I enjoy having my computer not be reliable or be difficult to use. Of course not. So the question is, what kinds of sacrifices you might or might not be willing to make in order to get the benefit of open code? What's
the benefit of open code as you see it?
Right, and that's exactly it. I would think that most authors of books these days don't especially care how the book gets from them into an actual stack of paper bound together in a certain way. That's the black box of the publishing business. You ship a Word document to your publisher, they give you a book. Who cares how they do it? It can be open or it can be closed.
I mean, some authors might say that they care whether it's printed on totally chlorine-free paper.
Right, so there might be particular aspects of it that you care about. You have certain requirements. I just can't work in a word processor without a spell checker. So even my open code word processor better have a spell checker. But somehow we're comfortable with the idea that real-world publishing, making books, is sufficiently hard and sufficiently complicated that really you want to hire someone, say a publisher, to do that for you. The question is software design so different, so much easier, or something that you think you should be able to do it yourself start to finish? I think it isn't. If it seems that way, it's just illusory, only in the short term.
In the back?
Hi. My name is Lisa Gregory. I'm a media consultant. I've been working at WCBA, so thanks for letting me interlope in the afternoon here this morning. But I wanted to follow up on what the first gentleman said about the interface with the content, because I think that we should all care about the code as it were, because I think the educational implications of it are really important. You know, what is, how is the software structured that allows for interactivity and real learning for students, for example? And so I feel like that should be an ongoing discussion about the structure of software and, in fact, the internet in general. You know, what is the nature of it?
And see, what I hear from that is the people who write the software and the people who are already teaching and would be in a position to use the software if it were written, there's this real divide between them. If it's the typical commercial proprietary model of, you know, Microsoft writes it in Redmond and then I find it available at the store someday. Now, I suppose that Microsoft struggles, just like any company might, to make software that will sell, and which means they want to understand what my needs are as a teacher or a student and make software that suits it. Is there some way that we would think that developing in a more open environment, one where the universities as collaborators in the code for teaching, are they going to be better able to make software that suits the environment than a remote company doing its best with market research? I mean,
I think they should be at the table. I think they should be part of crafting the discussion about what that structure looks like. So that was the point I was making. And I want to just give a general comment about the internet. Even though there are folks who talk about it as an opportunity to bring communities together, you know, it's just such an abundance of marketing. And so it suddenly becomes the wild, wild west of the marketing. And we kind of lose track of the conversation of content and education.
Okay, let me start passing this thing around.
Well, perhaps I'd like to give the mic right back to you, Jonathan. I'm wondering what we hope to come out of this discussion with. We could have a little vote, and maybe most of us will care, and a few won't, I suspect. But I am reading over some of the documents here. I get the impression that there's an interest in doing more with open code. And I guess just on this question, to me the important question is not who owns the code, but how open it is to go into an educational situation in which the student is deliberately kept ignorant about what the processes are involved and what he's doing seems to be a rather serious negation of all traditions of education, and so I would want to see that fixed. But I'm wondering, what do you hope will come from this meeting?
Yeah. To answer just the middle question first, it does seem to me that certainly in a computer science environment, that part of the university that studies how computers work and the theory of, you know, algorithmic computation, clearly to learn in an environment where you can't pick the thing apart is truly having a student be ignorant. You know, we wish we could show you this text, but I'm sorry, you can't see it. You just have to scrutinize the cover of the book to glean what's inside. So surely within that part of the university, there seems to be an argument as to why they ought to be able to be building and working with the stuff that they're studying. I'm speaking quite literally. If you're in the computer science department at a university, right, you could have people writing programs in Visual Basic for Microsoft, for which they can't get into Visual Basic for Microsoft. They can only play in the playpen that's defined by the code. There's an interesting recursion that I've seen in more open environments where not only can you code using the software that lets you code, but you can change the software that lets you code to, and you go as many levels down to, you're right down to the kernel of the machine. And that seems like a much more true to the tradition of the liberal arts environment in which to be studying computers than one in which the playpen is exactly this big and you're not supposed to leave the...
That's a concern for people in computers.
Right, exactly, exactly.
But can you articulate a concern that should be shared more broadly?
Yes, and that was the second. That's why I wanted to start with that first, just to get that point out. The second thing, and what I would want to take out, looking at this as a sort of strategic planning session, is we as a center, for example, have been involved in fits and starts with coding. Alex, who's up there, and Wendy, who unfortunately seems to have vanished. I don't know where Wendy went. She might be a content. Okay. Alex and Wendy were commissioned last summer, around this time, to do some software. And what that means is they actually wrote some Perl scripts. The scripts, in the first instance, I think, ran on NT. And the purpose of the scripts was to enable a web environment where students could be asked questions by a teacher. They'd have to answer the questions by a specific deadline. They would go into the web environment to answer them. After the deadline, as clocked by the computer, they could no longer answer them. Once they had done an answer at the deadline, each answer would be randomly routed to one other student in the class for a reaction, and the software would handle all of this. So from the point of view of the student, it was an easy-to-use environment on the web that was adjunct to the course syllabus and all the other stuff to get you into the course. From the point of view of the instructor, it was a chance to ask these questions and have things that track the material, again, in a completely easy-to-use environment enabled by the software that Alex and Wendy did. Now, there's no software out there that we know of, say from Microsoft or anybody else, that does this function. But as we look to, we did a second version of it over the winter, trying to implement it on Unix with scripts. And as now we look to an even more robust version where we want to actually have questions get asked in one class and for another class using the platform, were we to give it away to a bunch of other classes, where the curricula overlap actually having the questions zing back and forth so that Australian cyber law students are reacting to the statements from students, say, in my class. That's an idea for an advanced version. Now we're saying, to what extent does it make sense for the Berkman Center at Harvard Law School to be in the business of doing iterative versions of increasingly robust and commodified software? I mean, here we're now looking to give it away to an Australian cyber law class, which means it really has to work. They can't just call Alex up on the phone in the middle of the night, it would be, and say it's not working. So it's kind of a little bit of a minefield for us, just as a pure issue of, are we capable of coding, or is this, you know, we're Mickey Mouse with the brooms and we're learning just enough to be dangerous as we go beyond a little class project to a larger thing.
Would it be an evil suggestion to say, have you thought of charging for this in order to expand the resources of the Berkman Center, or is that against the basic principles?
Well, we're thinking of it sufficiently experimentally now that we don't want to ace anything out, that actually having a diversity of models for use of the software is one way of us doing research on what works and what doesn't. We don't want to have a negative cash flow. That really does seem not a long-term way of sustaining the effort. So maybe the way that Terry was talking about the cross-subsidization, it's actually through some of the pieces that we've put together, some of them proprietary. We buy iChat license off the shelf. So now our tools environment, as we call it, the Berkman Toolkit, supports chat. But it supports it because we bought it from iChat. It runs on our server, and you know that's how it goes. And then we also add our own custom-written scripts. All of that is at times sold. We have a law firm that paid us $7,500 so that they could go along with Terry's lecture and discussion series and have their own private confidential environment. And as Terry explained, it was very difficult for us to generate an environment where attorney-client privilege could truly be responsibly respected, and they had to have the discussion part on their server. It was a big, complicated thing. But we did that, and we didn't see it as contrary to our mission, both because it was cross-subsidizing, giving away the lecture and discussion for free, but also because it's a way of just experimenting with the different models. So, anybody? Yeah, go ahead.
Let's sort of go back a little bit to one of your other questions about why are we here kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so I am a lawyer practicing in Boston, and I'm curious about the legal implications of some of the stuff, which is, I thought, you know, a major thrust of this whole thing. And that I heard from Larry's speech this morning, sort of there was a theme to it. It's that our traditional system of copyright and patents and whatever we have in place for intellectual property protection is, to be very blunt, bad or something in the context of cyberspace and what its effects might be. And yet, I'm not sure what, I mean, it seems like all we've done in the system is given entrepreneurs and computer scientists the option, if they want, to protect their software or their inventions through these mechanisms of the law. But the fact that Richard Stallman and the Free Software Foundation have come up with another approach in terms of free software, and I think that it shouldn't, I actually was at a luncheon with Richard earlier this week and said, you know, free is just such a loaded word because it's not really economically free. It's what you are, the restrictions that are on it once you get it. that is still there. That's an option, so that if I'm in my garage and I come up with a neat software thing, I don't have to patent. I mean, I can give it away. But most people, it seems, given that they are materialistic things, choose to have some sort of protection. And so, I would say the mechanisms are in place now not to do it. The fact that people do it says something about other motives, and I'm not sure what we in the law could do or why we should do anything different.
Well, some people do it, some people don't, right? There is a whole free software movement, and its significance, I guess, is part of what's debated. But that says there's a whole other model that can exist in a world that offers the proprietary choice to software developers where you can renounce that choice or renounce every sliver of the choice except that one little sliver that says, I hold the copyright for the purpose of preventing those who may make derivative product out of my code from copywriting it themselves or from, you know, proprietizing it. So I agree that the strategic question we're trying to ask is, presuming that there is no sea change in the legal environment, so that there are all sorts of varying levels of proprietization that you could make of your code, if we're in the position of wanting to put together this toolkit, to what extent should we be strategically only incorporating that which is free, the way Stallman defines it, either by doing it ourselves or by drawing from a pool and then turning around and contributing back to it of software that has been designated free? Or to what extent, you know, so what? We've got an iChat server license. iChat is proprietary. It's closed software. Now, if we want to share that platform, if we actually want to make it so that the Australian cyber law people or whoever else can run it on their machine, they, of course, at the very least, are going to have to turn around and cut a deal with iChat because they can't use our license, say. And so I guess that's one reason to think that doing it ourselves would be better. But there may be other reasons as well.
Could respond to that?
Sure.
I think the issue you face is not a legal issue, but a business issue. And I think it's the same issue that people in their garage and Richard Stallman have faced, and it comes to sort of what are your priorities. And I think the obvious trade-off that people look in terms of free software is, but I'm not going to get rich. There's an economic sacrifice to that. I think Red Hat is very interesting in that they think that, you know, and Richard would say they're not doing free software, though they say they are, that they think they have come up with a way that will give them an economic return. And so I think it becomes so that if you're sitting here, you need, you know, I imagine at some point you'll say, what are the goals of the Berkman Center? I bet it's not to make money. So that money will not be as high on your list of priorities, so you would not be, you know, as it wouldn't be such a barrier to you to give it away. But for people who, you know, who have their families and stuff, unless they can come up with an economic model that will reward them, they tend to shy away from the freedom, though I think Red Hat may provide a paradigm that'll be different.
So that's one question. Do we have to indulge the assumption that if you opt to create in a free environment, the way that Richard might define it, does that mean you basically have to take a vow of poverty? And you either do it as an Elie Mossenary choice, or, I mean, are there any knights of open code who renounce the idea that the only way to make money off of software is through making it proprietary?
Is that what you are asking? Where could we give away and at the same time find funding? Is it a funding question? Is it a business question? What are we talking about?
Well, I agree. It's not primarily a legal question. It's not about, at least at this point, you know, how can we change the laws? I mean, the case that Larry's involved in is maybe that. But in this case, what we're asking is, can we, if we were to operate in a completely open environment with respect to our software,
right.
Does that mean then we're going to have to find some source of funding because we're essentially having to give it away, that there's no way to get money back through the process?
May I make just a suggestion as to the structure of this discussion?
Yeah, sure.
Yes? One question is, what is the cheapest way to get what you want? Is it off the shelf, so Microsoft or whatever, where you buy, or is it do it yourself? That's an economic, a business question. the more customized you are, the more you have to do it yourself. Yes? So this is number one. Number two, in both cases, where do we take the money to buy either off the shelf or to buy by customizing, by doing it ourselves? That's a different question.
Well, you could imagine, though, you spend more money to do the custom development, maybe, but if it were part of a commons to which you were giving the results and then drawing yet more from, if you were part of that club, you could actually see it costing you less in the end than it would if you bought off the shelf. I mean, that's at least one way of conceiving it.
As you well know better than I, there are business models in software where people give it away for free, but then they make their money on the upgrades, the add-ons, the additional things that are charged for. So you can give it away for free and to try to establish a standard, especially. Whether it's free or not initially to the user is not the only topic. I'm still not quite sure why owning the code that we run on seems to me that the normative issue ultimately has to do with shared access and the ability to share interactions and material with other people. I mean, I used to have tremendous trouble getting and receiving attachments, and I don't know, just through the upgrade.
Yeah. Tell me what you've learned.
Well, no, but just it happening, the people I tend to collaborate with, just because of the happenstance of the upgrades, my systems have gone on, the upgrades, their system. We finally found out that we're all now on Microsoft Word, and we don't have any problem sharing attachments.
Until you're on Microsoft Word 2000,
well,
among two of you.
Maybe, but...
I mean, this isn't happenstance, that's all I'm saying.
No, what I'm saying is, we're now, you know, it all works, and we don't own it, you know, but it all works, and it didn't work before, and we were all in different things, and various complicated kinds of attachments. Now, it just happens, maybe next year it'll change again, I don't know. But it seems to me we were just on different systems, and different standards, and we couldn't. I would send an attachment, and people, I'd finally turn it into a fax in order to get it to the other person.
The underlying point to a lot of the discussion is not a matter of just because it's proprietary doesn't mean that it will work or won't work. Just because it's open doesn't mean it will work or won't work. But the methodology of the process you go through, even someone who's not a computer science person,
right.
I am a CS person. And I would tell you right now, I mean, if from one version of Word to the other, from one word process to the other, formats were documented and were public and were open, you would never have that problem. Point blank. If someone in Japan wants to write a text file, they're using a character set, someone in America wants to read it,
if that's all documented, it doesn't break. You know how to deal with it, and that's an important thing, I think, for a researcher in history who's doing studies on Aramaic scripts on some biblical text or something. There is a certain amount of value in having specifications and having standards and having the tools they use be open so that they can turn to their CS friends. I mean, you know, when we look at a university, it really bothers me when I hear discussions where a history department is by itself, an economics department is on its own. The university has resources. If they have a CS department, they really ought to use it. You know, and having done a lot of coding when I was in school for the university and seeing, I went to Johns Hopkins and I was just talking to my old boss by email, I was telling him I was coming here, and he was interested because Hopkins is doing a similar process internally to start sort of organizing the development of code internally. And so the question came up when I was talking to him, you know, well, I wonder what they're doing. You know, I wonder if we can help each other out. And I think that becomes an important tool even within a university. I mean, if someone is doing research on a foreign language, you get you have an open tool. You can do the exchange and work that out. I'm sort of coming up with on the fly, but that's just my first response to that type of story is that, you know, I think the fact that it was closed caused your problem, not the fact that it was, you know, whatever, you know, other issues are there. I mean, if that were documented, if that were open, someone would have fixed it within, and that would have never broken in the first place, I think, because WordPerfect would always have been able to read Word. The latest version of Word would have always had the functionality to read an old version of Word. I mean, that sort of thing, it's just a small aspect of the greater question, I think.
Welcome, Richard. We've been talking about you.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well,
speak of the devil.
Yeah. So I saw Alex wanted to get
it. I just wanted to unpack ownership a little because we've been talking about a lot and what it means and all of this talk. I'm all for Ben's system of closed code as long as I can get a contract with whoever's owning the software such that any new additions that I want to make to the software, I can make. Such that if I want to give the software away to my friends once I make additions, I can do that. So the concept of ownership is really a whole group of different things, some of which are very important to me. Back to Ben's first example about book publishing, the amazing thing about some of these code issues is that if a bunch of us could get together as writers and just one time develop a method of publication for a book, just do it once, invest that money, never have to go back to the publishers again, if we wanted to change that method of publication, if we wanted to have bold italics or something on the title page, we could do that internally. If we could do that, and it was a one-time investment, it might make sense. You know, it might still not. And one of the questions I hope to have an answer to coming out of this meeting is, in what case does it make sense for us as the Berkman Center to develop in-house? And in what circumstances is it much more feasible to buy something off the shelf and close? And when should we not care that we're using closed software? When should we care?
So why don't we actually, since Richard has just joined us, why don't we put it over to you? I mean, we're okay. Trying to think of some strategy here. So the question we have is, here we are, we're a research center on a law school. We have software we'd like to deploy in a classroom environment. It doesn't exist out there yet. If we're building it out of different components, should we care how much those components are open or closed, free or not?
I think that there's... In any endeavor, the most important thing is to keep your mind on the goal and on the spirit of the goal. That's more important than the detailed practical steps you take to achieve the goal, because if those practical steps conflict with the spirit, people will see that, and you'll come to nothing except perhaps profit extracted in a sleazy way. If that were your goal, you could achieve it, but that's not the kind of goal you have. So that kind of approach would be totally pointless to consider. If you want to spread the idea of the freedom to cooperate and of a community where people can cooperate, you've got to go beyond the ordinary level in the way you live, because that shows you're sincere.
People in a law school environment, as an example again, of a non-techie environment that has people like Alex and Wendy who are capable of coding. I mean, is it actually something we could hope to do?
Of course you can. But, you know, whether you can do a specific job, you know, I'm afraid that you seem to be trying to talk at the same time about a very general question and about specific technical questions. Unfortunately, I don't know which specific technical questions. For any group of programmers, there are some jobs they could do and some they couldn't do. They may not know in advance which ones they are until they try, but it's also the case that for whatever you're really trying to accomplish, there are probably many technical methods that would work to do the job. So I wonder if you have made a full effort to explore all the ways you can use existing free software to get the job done, even if it is not quite as convenient as you might imagine it could be. Because I suspect that if you are willing to accept a certain amount of inconvenience for the sake of a principle, that you could get the job done with existing free software and you don't have to change anything.
This ties back to a point Eric made before you came in, which was the recycled paper. If you believe in a commitment, let's say you are the World Wildlife Foundation, it would be a practical step not in line with your overall goal to put out your fundraising materials on non-recyclable paper.
Right.
So I understand that point, but I'm wondering, is there any other reason in which the way back to haunt us?
Well, it can always come back to haunt anyone, but it's a mistake to focus on that question. That question, suppose it wouldn't come back to haunt you in some specifically practical way, that's a minor side issue, because the important thing is, have you practiced what you preach, in a sense? Have you shown sincerity? That's far, far more important than any of the practical issues.
Does it trouble you to drive a closed car?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't use the term closed, and I'm not sure what that means.
Being a car for which a patent has been obtained.
No, it doesn't, because I don't. There are no car copiers. If I had a car copier, then I would have. Then the issue for copying cars would be just like the issue of copying software or anything else that you publish that you have on your computer. But since we don't have car copiers, and until nanotechnology is developed or Star Trek transporters, we won't have car copiers, it's a moot question in ordinary life.
Let me just rephrase the question. I really am trying to think of it as how far that commitment goes. I mean, would you worry about closed versus open?
Again, I don't use the term closed and open because I think because those draw attention away from the issue of freedom. I think in terms of freedom to form a community. And that issue becomes relevant in the when you're working with the kinds of things for which it is fundamentally feasible to have that kind of community. I don't know what a free thermostat would mean, you know, one you can you're free to copy. Well, again, we don't have thermostat copiers, and one that you're free to well, if there's if it is designed in such a way that you never load any kind of software into it and it just doesn't have any mechanism to load software in, then again, the issue doesn't arise. It doesn't affect your life. You know, whether you're allowed to copy software into it or not will not affect you if it isn't really feasible to copy any software into it.
How does it affect my life?
When you... let me tell you, because when you have something on your computer, it is feasible for you to copy it and share it. And that's the situation where we can feasibly have a community of people who copy and share and improve things. And then, when you tell them that they're forbidden to, you are doing some real harm to them and require draconian laws to make them actually stop. No draconian laws are needed to stop people from copying cars, because we can't copy cars. But if we had car copiers, then draconian laws would be required to stop people from copying cars, and that would be truly antisocial, and we'd have to campaign for the freedom to copy them. Imagine if we had food copiers, then they'd start selling you food with licenses saying you're not allowed to let anybody outside your immediate family consume any of this food without a special payment, and you want to invite a friend over for dinner. What does that do, right? They'd be turning society upside down.
Well, you have some form of food copying called
well, but you can't do, but ordinary people are really can't really feasibly copy them very much. Yes, you can plant a garden. It's a lot of work. But you can't just copy the tomato. And indeed, those are becoming important issues, but I think the main reason why those issues of plant and animal variety patents are important are different, actually, because there are areas of the world where a lot of people, in fact, are engaged in copying food, but not here in the U.S.
Okay, but if we try to adopt the new Emacs, the word processor, there'd be some inconvenience, perhaps, because we had a bunch of people previously trained on
words. It's a tangent.
Yeah.
However, there are free word processors that are user-friendly. So once again, I'm coming back to the point I made before, that I have a feeling that you're supposing, that you're making a supposition about how much trouble it would be to use all free software without having investigated to see what options are available. It's a mistake to make a speculation about how much inconvenience there will be and argue based on that you can't accept it without looking for more convenient free alternatives and seeing what they are. You know, there's Lix, there's ABI Suite, which are both free word processors.
you were approaching with the CARCA. What is the issue of, would you just articulate for us? We have questions about it, but it would be useful for the discussion if you would articulate for us what is the issue of principle, not convenience, but the issue of principle as to why we should care.
Why should you care about free software?
Yes.
Well, I should explain, first of all, what free software means. Free software means that you, the user, have certain freedoms. The freedom to run the program, that's freedom zero. The freedom to modify the program to suit your needs, that's freedom one. The freedom to redistribute copies, that's freedom two. And the freedom to publish improved versions and help build a community, that's freedom three. Now, these freedoms are important for both practical reasons and psychosocial reasons. If you don't have freedom one, for example, the freedom to modify the software, then that causes practical harm, as you've already discussed. But it also causes psychosocial harm, because when people are being forced to use painful tools and forbidden to improve them, that hurts their morale. And that's bad for all society.
I've also discovered that the freedom one is freedom that's hard to grasp. I mean, it's like I'm free to climb in layers.
No, it's, you may not be, but somebody else, you know, but you could learn to be if you want, and it's not as hard or as dangerous as climbing Mount Everest. So don't exaggerate. There are probably only hundreds of people who, maybe 1,000 by now, who have climbed Everest, but there are probably more than 1 million programmers in the world, and maybe a few million. And even if you don't learn programming enough that you could write something like Emacs, you might learn some programming and fix something when you wanted to. And even if you personally don't want to use it, you could hire somebody else to do the work you want. So if you have the freedom, then you can get somebody else to do the work for you, especially if you work for an organization that has money and can hire people from time to time. So, and for any business, for a business executive, for example, freedom number one is very important, even if that executive never intends to learn any programming. But I want to focus, though, on the fact that aside from this material harm that happens if you lose freedom one, there's also a psychosocial harm that affects the people who are prisoners of their software. With freedom two, the freedom to redistribute copies, well, if people don't have that freedom, there's a practical harm because the program goes partly to waste. It's deliberately inflicted waste because there's a financial disincentive discouraging people from using the program. But there's also a psychosocial harm when you tell people if you share with your neighbor, you're a pirate. Sharing with your neighbor is forbidden. That attacks civic spirit, goodwill, which is the fundamental resource of any society. So this is tremendously important to the kind of society we want to have.
Okay, so
is a freedom to publish improved versions, which helps build your community. If we don't have this freedom, there's a practical harm. We lose the benefit of many people working together to improve the software, the thing that Eric Raymond talks about so well. But in addition, there's psychosocial harm. It affects the spirit of scientific or scholarly cooperation. And it also affects civic spirit. And so these freedoms are important not only for practical reasons. If they had no practical effect, well, who cares? The psychosocial reasons wouldn't be there if it weren't for the fact that these things have a practical effect as well. But because they do have a practical effect, they also have psychosocial consequences. They affect the kind of society we can have. And that,
okay,
I believe,
so
is the most
I'm
important
sorry, Richard,
reason.
Let me spread around the freedom of speech a little bit, though, and then come back to you. Let me just, Ben, did you have something? And there's people in the back, too.
I sure. I guess what I find hardest about all of that is the suggestion that some companies in what I guess most people would call now legitimate businesses, making things that some people find useful and are happy to pay for, are okay by you and some aren't. If you make cars, that's okay because cars are unclonable.
Objection is that I haven't chosen one of two simplistic and totally opposed viewpoints.
I wouldn't have put it that way. If you're...
Just because you can't do it doesn't mean that it's wrong or right. Just because you can't call it have, shouldn't be the argument.
No, since it isn't something we can do in practice, it's a moot point at the moment whether we are allowed to. In the same way, copyright in the age of the printing press was not a problem for readers because it restricted something that you couldn't do as an ordinary reader. It restricted, you had to be an author or a publisher to be restricted by copyright. Because of that, I think it was a reasonable system in the age of the printing press.
What you're essentially saying is, if you refuse to share that which is already difficult to share, it's not as big a deal as if you're trying to refuse to share that which can be costlessly shared.
Or if you try to forbid someone else to share what he can't share anyway, you're not doing anything to him.
So let's keep it going.
Before coming, I took this paper by David Bollier off the website, The Power of Openness, a Critique and a Proposal. And I kind of like some of his proposals, and I'm not hearing them on the table here. And I'm wondering if there is any prospect of them getting on the table, particularly the proposal to create a software users alliance. I think that's an excellent idea and one that's badly needed because I have found that the software industry, particularly the large companies, have been treating the public in a most abysmal fashion. And I would really like to see that something along that line happen.
Well, I'm actually curious, and at some risk to the fore, let me ask you, Richard. I don't know if you read Bollier's doc. It was in very large part derived from your work and with many references to it. Copied, but in the spirit of openness. What piece of the puzzle, aside from actually legislating different things or unlegislating certain things, what piece of the puzzle to you would best enable or best that much more add fuel to the open source software movement, if anything?
Well, I'm part of the free software movement, not the open source movement.
Forgive the obvious errors I'm making.
Okay, philosophically, they have totally different viewpoints.
Yeah.
And I've just told you the viewpoint of the free software movement. The open source people would disagree with a lot of what I said, and therefore, please do not ever refer to me as part of the open source movement or speak to me as if what I do were... as if I expecting you to think of it as open source. And if any of you agree with me, I hope you will call it free software as well. Help stand up for the Freedom Party.
By the way, there are a number of people that don't know the difference. I'm among them. So you should...
The open source people cite the practical benefits of having many people, of allowing the users to get involved in developing the software and fixing it. And this is one of, for me, this is one of the benefits. So I agree with them on what they say, but where I disagree with them is in their decision to avoid any mention of freedom, avoid talking about this as an issue of right or wrong, as a matter of principle. They just say it's convenient for software to have the same freedoms essentially that I described are the ones they advocate, but they advocate them purely for practical reasons, and they avoid as if it were a hot potato referring to any kind of issue of principle.
If it turns, and you, do you take a position as to whether, for practical reasons, it's better or worse, or it could be either way?
It could be either way. I find often it is better. I won't claim that it's inevitably so. And I would choose free software even when it's technically inferior because I won't give up my freedom for the extra convenience of a program that puts shackles on its users.
Ben, did you have something more you wanted to say?
You were bringing up the users' alliance.
The
users' alliance. Was that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
I thought that's what you were.
Go with the users' alliance.
You want me to talk, or just, you know, you just, or someone else talk, or?
No, I'm delighted to have your contributions. I understand.
I tried to start a not just software, but anything published online, users' alliance, and maybe not even limited to online. It's called the Union for the Public Domain, but the other people who were founders of it didn't want to go as far as I did, and they wanted to just resist extensions of copyright power, and my goal was to roll copyright power back to some extent.
So as a political matter, would forming the kind of alliance that David calls for, and David Bollier himself is somewhat new to the politics of the movement, and one of the critiques of the Bollier document that came out on, say, Slashdot, where it was placed and where a lot of people that have been much more associated with the movement hang out, one of the critiques was, great, you know, now that we've happened and we've come into the mainstream a little bit, note has been taken of our work, now people come along and say, great, we're going to co-opt the work, we're going to copy it, and we're here to help. Now, I am curious then, given your experience with, say, a Software Users Alliance, do the politics permit such a thing, or is it such a fragmented community?
You can't say. I mean, it depends. I'm sure many things are possible depending on whether you find organizers with the initiative and determination to do something. You know, look at any political issue. You'll probably find people with many views, and there probably could be possible many different organizations representing different ranges of views. So I'm sure many different kinds of things are possible. I'm not sure what Bollier is proposing. You know, I might want to support it. I might disagree with it. I might think I agree, but it doesn't go far enough, or who knows what.
Right. In the case where you agree, but it doesn't go far enough?
I would support it, but I'd want to see something else that went far enough.
Yeah. There are a bunch of people back there. You've already forgotten me. Sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
So, Richard, I have a question for you, and I tremble to ask the question because I think I'm going to get slammed for it. But I ask it to you out of respect, and which is and I saw you earlier this week. I don't know if you remember it, those hostile patent lawyers around the lunch table. I represent software, young software companies, and I think the choice they see if you talk about free software is it's a choice of freedom versus intellectual versus economic prosperity, and that if I do free software, I'm not going to be rich. So, do you have how do you answer that?
I answer it by saying that it shouldn't be up to the rules for the kind of community we all have shouldn't be decided by a few people based on whether they want to be rich. You know, I won't say necessarily that it's wrong for anyone to be rich. I'm not a communist. But on the other hand, I wouldn't say that giving a few people an opportunity to possibly become rich is the greatest social imperative, and that all the rules for how the rest of us live should be decided for the sake of giving them that chance.
But do you think that the model of free software is such that if you could imagine an eleemosynary organization, something that had a pile of money, a foundation, and it wants to do good in the world, if it were to say, you know, we'd like to give $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 a month to programmers who would program using the free software model to support this, it's kind of like the endowment for the arts or something.
I think that might be useful. The Free Software Foundation does that, although we don't pay quite that much. We pay something more like $3,000. but, you know, there are businesses that develop free software and support free software. There are people who make a living developing free software. It may be true that they don't have the opportunity to become rich. So the question is, how do we want to decide what kind of society we should have? Should programmers or people who want to be executives of software companies make the decision in a self-serving way for everybody, or should the rest of us decide based on what's good for users?
Yeah, go ahead.
Doesn't everyone have the option right now whether they want to make their software free or whether they want to sell it? So doesn't that model already exist and people can choose to make a million or they can choose to distribute for the good of the world?
I think that's very clear, Richard.
Because I'm having a hard time understanding.
It does, yes. That's the current legal situation.
Then why should we change that?
Because it's not right for software to shackle its users.
Well, everyone's making their own independent choice. If I'm choosing to buy shackled software,
you are also hurting your neighbors and the community you could have been part of when you agree to that.
But you're saying that someone who does the development doesn't have a right to...
Right. I don't believe that person should be entitled, should be have the power to set such conditions for other people who use the software.
But the people that made the car had the right to sell it.
That's a totally unrelated issue. Everyone should have the right to sell copies of software. Selling, the word selling, when we usually apply it to software, includes a number of different things that tend to go together, especially in the proprietary software world, they go together. So we haven't needed to pry them apart. But when you start using that concept in a discussion of free software, where these things that are have gone together start being separated. And so using the term sell can get you confused if you don't make it more precise. And they're selling copies, which, you know, we sell copies of free software, and there are companies that sell copies of free software, and they make money. So
you're not arguing against that?
Not at all. Selling copies isn't the issue. The issue is whether users have freedom to do certain things.
But if people sell the, and if people have the right to set whatever price they want on the copies that they sell,
well,
then it's not free.
Law does provide a baseline of some kind. For example, the law does not permit you to own an idea. You can express an idea and then you can protect the expression, but the first person who came up with Boy Meets Girl as a plot line can't say, you know, any other work for which it's boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl, I want the option to say I'm going to get royalties. And I can choose, maybe I'll give it to society for the freedom of arts, or I'm going to hold it close because I came up with it first. Law doesn't permit that to happen.
Well, right, I disagree with that. I think that's a bad policy. So I would change laws, although exactly what I would change I'm not sure of, since I've never been offered the opportunity to enact laws. I would like to see proprietary software, at least among published software, disappear, but I'm not committed to any one way that should happen.
My concern would be that if you don't have a financial motivation, that there is a large group of people that are financially motivated, and we won't have either the speed of development that's required to keep pace or the quality. And quality can be, you know, argued for a long time. But I just think that if you don't financially reward people, you're not going to get the results.
If you can give a brief answer to that and then pass it off to anyone who wants to get in.
People told me that when I started the free software movement, and they said, programmers said, in effect, if you don't let me control the users, I won't write software, and then you'll be sorry. And I said to them, okay, don't, because I don't want software to be written. I don't think it contributes to society. I don't consider it a laudable activity which ought to have special government issued privileges to encourage it if it's going to shackle the users and not allow them to be a community. So I told them, okay, don't. I didn't know at the time whether free software could fill the need. Today we know it because we're developing so much free software, and it's powerful and it's high quality, and we're doing this despite the fact that governments still have these policies that encourage people not to join us. So if those policies were changed, clearly we would develop a lot more free software. And the more people get used to things like buying support for free software, the more successful free software businesses will become, and the more people will be able to make money working on free software. So it's clear we've already proved that that worry is unnecessary.
So, yeah, up to Nolan, and then hopefully you can remember the thought when Nolan's done. Okay.
In response to your question, it seems to me that you're raising issues as to why would people publish or produce intellectual products without a financial incentive. I think artists and poets do it all the time. I paint and I give a lot of it away, and I'm not in it, and I don't do it for economic incentives. My concern is with the discussion, it seems to be somewhat limited to defining digital information in computers or on storage devices, i.e. software, differently than other information. Why should software be free and not other information? Why shouldn't all information be free under the principles that you're articulating? Another issue is why shouldn't government, in that it has a he's accountable to the people. This is one of his roles, is to eliminate insecurity. Why shouldn't it be a publisher of last resort of all of these things, of free software, of base code, not directly compete with those who want to make money on it, but provide at least the basic underlying resources for society to raise it to the level of a quality of life that we all want.
I sort of want to address both of them. As far as providing economic incentives, Richard did talk about selling copies of free software, and that's this really can happen. I mean, you can print a manual on paper rather than just putting it on the disk, and that's something that's tangible. But a lot of people like to I like manuals on paper. Look at a product like I'll pull one out of thin air, Microsoft Word. If you go to a store and buy it, what's it, $70-$80 these days? I haven't purchased one recently. If you want to get something like, and I'll stretch free software a little bit, if you want to get something like Red Hat Linux, $60-$70, it's the same cost. It's the same cost to the user. One of them is a piece of software that shackles you. One of them isn't. It sounds to me, listening to the discussion, like the population needs to be educated about the fact that Microsoft Word is shackling them, and the world at large doesn't know that. The gentleman down in the front row wasn't looking at it from that perspective at all. When he got everybody using Microsoft Word, everything worked for them, and he didn't see it as they were all shackled into using the same version of Microsoft Word. It's not the way we're conditioned to think about things, so we go on doing it the way we have been. And maybe some of the focus needs to be more towards educating people that this isn't the only way to do it. And what he was saying is, if this had been open from the start, if everybody knew how to read Microsoft Word files and attachments, however Microsoft Exchange attaches things, then it wouldn't matter. And just to address his point real quick about all information being free, one of the issues I had this morning during Larry's talk that I didn't bring up, but struck me is, where does privacy come into this? I mean, associating a database somewhere that associates my credit card number with my name is a piece of information. I don't want the whole world to know it. That's private. I don't want the world to know my social security number. I don't want the world to know what I bought on my credit card. I don't want Michael Eisner to know that I'm flying to Florida next month because I'm not going to see him. Where do you draw the line with what information is free and what's not?
Well, I've already drawn concerning privacy, the fact that it's available on a database doesn't mean you can buy it in any event.
I think I could argue that the privacy line isn't drawn, but
there's another question about privacy also is that you don't even own that information, nor do you necessarily know.
You're right.
That information is contained in somebody else's database.
I don't own my credit card number, and lots of legal documents are written so that, just like shackling software, you don't own this piece of software. You own the right to use this piece of software on one computer as long as we don't revoke it, is the way the licenses are written. And, credit card numbers, even email addresses, things like that are licensed under that kind of term. But if we talk about freeing all information, then Visa could free that information that I bought 2 airline tickets to go to Florida next month. I don't see the distinction how that's not an invasion of privacy or how that's not total freedom of information.
Believe it or not, we actually have to wrap up pretty soon.
Okay.
Did you have something?
Well,
and then,
Jim,
I guess, try to put
it
together.
Synthesis
kind of
this. I wonder if, because it was interesting, the initial thing was
open, we'd answer. Oh, exactly. What I hear free software being one end of the spectrum, which is extremely open, the other end being, let's say, Microsoft proprietary executable. That's all you get. And so I think, you know, if you go back to the issue of, well, what's a Berkman Center going to do? Well, you know, maybe you want to make the source code available, maybe, you know, without making it free in Richard's sense. Because so there are a lot of options on the spectrum that are available. And so then I think about, well, what does it mean legally? What, you know? And I guess there's a part of me that says, I think, and this is where I listen to Richard and I want to, you know, most people don't care. That if I get Microsoft Word, I don't want to touch it. I don't care. And so I wonder a little bit, you know, that eventually maybe if everybody becomes super computer literate, the market will decide by saying I'll only buy software that I can modify. But until that day, I think the system is okay.
How much say do you want to have in terms of, to go back to the writer stuff? Do you want, as a citizen, to be able to be included in the discussion of what information that you consider private is automatically, say, or made available without your consent? And there's any number of instances in the last couple of years where it's turned out that Microsoft products are, in fact, transferring things from your computer without your knowledge, say.
I think that's different.
There are different senses of freedom impinged on this discussion. I now understand the sense of freedom you've clarified, and it's a legitimate point. People will vary in this room as to how much they care about it. That is, the freedom to buy software that can be modified or the freedom to modify software is something that most people will not care about deeply. Maybe they should, or maybe they could be educated to. And I'm apparently suffering from false consciousness because I didn't realize that by buying Microsoft Word I was shackled. But, you know, that's fine. There are many forms of false consciousness. An area that I did care about more when I first heard about it was the cookies, you know, if I go to certain websites, cookies or magic cookies will be embedded in my computer that will report back about my consumer habits. Now, I find freedom from that kind of surveillance is something that I would like to have and like to have better control of. I understand there's certain complicated ways I can stop all the cookies, but then that may have a cost in terms of what websites I can have access to. Now, that I think is a real legitimate issue that the Berkman Center ought to be doing more about. And it doesn't quite get to the ownership of the code, but it gets to the control of the code that is on your computer.
Yeah.
So I'd just like to mention that on the agenda.
We are running dangerously low on time. The one thing on the cookies is, to my knowledge, the cookie protocol is part of an open, those may not like open versus closed, but a protocol that was developed that is not proprietary, such that at least we know what we don't know. We know that the cookie is there, and this is how it works, and we like it or we don't.
Right.
Versus,
users have no idea.
But again, compare compare to Microsoft Office, which has the global user ID buried in the code, not even the Ralph Nader components of the watchdogs can easily see it.
With free software, we can solve this problem. If it were free software, even if you're not a programmer, some other programmer will object to the cookies being used in any particular way, and they would implement the features you would want, because you're not the only one who'd want them. If you had some particular need nobody shared, maybe it would have to be, you'd have to do it yourself or pay someone. But for this, with free software, it will respond to the wishes of the community. The privacy issue is somewhat of a red herring, because if you notice, I've been speaking about the freedom to share published information. Published information being information that anybody could go and get. And so that's, you have no privacy when, for information that's been published. Now, I value privacy rights very much, but what we need to preserve privacy for online information that people are keeping isn't copyright. Copyright won't do it, because you don't own the copyright on the information about you.
So Richard, forgive me.
Forget that. Forget privacy is a separate issue. It's very important,
great,
go to Epic
great.
And discuss.
Thank you. This gentleman, and I want to just say a word and wrap up, but go ahead.
Okay, well, I'd like to go into a 20-minute rant about how the present system is not okay.
as was suggested here. To be very brief, in the early 1970s, IBM developed an approach to describing software, which provided a lot of simplicity of expression. Neither they nor anyone else is doing anything that advanced today. Digital Equipment Corporation distinguished itself by setting back the leading edge of its software technology backwards by 15 years at one point. Almost any technology pays a great deal of attention to its basic structures, whether it's arrowheads or bricks or turbine blades. The innovators really take a look at what those basic structures are. So what do we know about the basic structures of information? What's a reasonable structure for a data object? How many think they know the answer to that question, a good answer? No one. This is a very profound and completely unique kind of ignorance, I think. No other technology has done this. I tried to go to my management at Digital Equipment Corporation, pointing out the advantages of understanding that and what it could do for the quality of the customer's information. Its accessibility, its usability, its cohesiveness, its clarity. Here you are making billions of dollars a year on software, which is destroying the quality of the customer's information in these ways. Aren't you eager to fix this problem, and aren't you glad I'm telling you about it? You can imagine the stony response I got. And many others performed the same way. And we are in a terrible state, I think, and one that we really need to do something about.
Yeah, thank you. So let me tell you where we're at right now, which I know we've had a somewhat scattered session. We started with the idea of founding something called opencode.org, which would contain some of the action items that are in the Bollier document that's in the binder. That's still something on the table, although one of the first reactions we got from the university was, you're not allowed to start something. Well, what do you mean you start opencode.org? You know, Berkman Center can't do it. You're not free to do that. Now, surely certain individuals are free to do as they please in their spare time, but it actually brought up very quickly fault lines even within the university about what its mission is and what it's all about and what its constituent parts can do, which regress into the very debate over open and close that is the purpose of something like opencode.org. So part of the goal of today, rather than to be, let's break a champagne bottle over the prow of a new opencode.org, is actually to dwell a little bit on the issues and think about building a case within the university environment for why universities in particular, and nonprofits generally, foundations, you know, .org as well as .edu, have a stake in this and should be caring about these issues. So that does take us one level of abstraction higher, as we've been talking today. And the one way we've gotten concrete has been to say, all right, we are a .org, we're a .edu, we have a mission that we're trying to undertake. How do these issues practically bear on what we're doing, both as a matter of vision that we wish to implement the recycled paper argument, but also in very practical ways as we are thinking of trying to develop software ourselves as novice mountain climbers for use in the teaching process. So that's sort of where we're at and why, in a way, it's been as scattered as it is. And with that, I think we'd better give up this room for the plenary session, which should be starting any minute. So, thank you.
For the record, I'm going to call it water, so, yeah.